Okay, welcome to church today. My name's Toby, and we're starting a new series today called My Problem with Christianity. Over January and December, we surveyed lots of people in our city, and we came up with the top four problems people have with Christianity. And over the next four weeks, we're looking at, hasn't science buried God? Isn't Christianity anti-sex and anti-freedom? How can I believe in Jesus when his followers have done such terrible things? And if God exists, why wouldn't he prevent the evil and suffering that we see in the world? So there's the four problems, top four problems we found people had toward Christianity. And if you surveyed your friends and they asked a different question, had a different problem, I'm very sorry we weren't able to cram it in this period and into this series, but hopefully we'll get to cover it again sometime in the future. So today we come to this question, hasn't science buried God? And really it's a very important question, isn't it? Because many people today do think that science in general and evolution in particular has made belief in God unnecessary and obsolete. Richard Dawkins, that famous Oxford biologist, wrote a very famous book by the title of The God Delusion, in which he said belief in God is a delusion, and that in former generations we needed to believe in God to account for the incredible complexity of the world we live in. But Darwin has solved that problem for us, and no longer do we need to believe in God. And so Dawkins argues, he goes even further to say that actually if you're an intellectual, if you're a serious, rational thinker, then actually belief in God is not just unneeded, but it's a delusion that we've created to try and account for and deal with our fears about death. And so that's the question. Is Dawkins right? Has science essentially buried God? Do we have to choose between thinking scientifically and believing in God? Many people think that is the case. And I think in order to answer this question, hasn't science buried God? I think I want to break it down into four questions. And that is a question of history, a question of miracles, a question of evolution, and the question of faith. In other words, hasn't religion in general, and Christianity in particular, suppressed science and persecuted scientists? That's the question of history. And the second question is the question of miracles. Aren't miracles, by definition, scientifically impossible? That's the question of miracles. Third question is the question of evolution. Doesn't evolution disprove the Bible, in particular, the start of the Bible? And then the fourth question is a question of faith. Isn't faith by definition believing where there is no evidence? So Toby, how can a scientist in response to history, miracles, evolution, and this thing called faith, how can you expect me to believe in God? I think they're the four challenges that make many people conclude that science has buried God. And so what I want to do is just address each one of these four questions: the question of history, the question of miracles, evolution, and faith. So let's begin with the question of history, the history of science. It is common belief that scientists today and throughout history don't believe in God. Many people think that is the case. But what is the evidence for this? Well, I want to take a little bit of a roundabout way to do this. And I want to do it by starting with that Bible reading which Christian read for us, which is John chapter 1, actually the reading we had last week. I just want you to focus in, if you've got a little one of the booklets that you received on the way in, you can pick it up there. And I just want to focus really on the first two, three sentences there. This is John's gospel. John was one of the followers of Jesus, a disciple. He spent 3 years with Jesus up until his death, and he claimed to see Jesus risen from the dead. And the way he starts his biography of Jesus is by saying this: in the beginning was the Word. And that word, Word, means reason, or the Greek word logos. In the beginning was the logos, the reason. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning, and through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing that has been made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. And so here the Bible gives an explanation for why the universe is scientifically intelligible. There is a reason. There is a logos. There is a principle. There is a mind behind the universe. And there's a meaning at the heart of the universe because there is a creator. In the beginning was the Word, the reason, the meaning, the logos, a mind. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through this mind, reason, logos, the Bible says, through Him, all things were made. This is the account in the Bible which tells us why actually our processes of understanding the world around us actually make sense. This is the question that has baffled scientists in history is this: how is it that what goes on in our tiny heads can give us anything of a true account of reality? How is it that a mathematical equation thought up in the human mind, the mind of a mathematician, how is it possible that that can correspond with the universe out there? It's reflection on this problem, this question, that led Einstein to say that the only incomprehensible thing in the universe is that it is comprehensible. Does that make sense? He's saying it's actually a massive problem for scientists to work out why is it that we are able to look at the world around us and to deduct from the world around us what is and what isn't. Why is the universe intelligible at all? Now, the naturalistic explanation, that is, if you don't believe in God and all you believe in is the world around you, the things you can taste, touch, see, and feel and put in a test tube or something like that, the naturalistic and materialistic view of the world, it says that our minds are the product of natural selection and evolution. And the reasons we have evolved to be what we are right now has nothing at all to do with truth, but everything to do with survival. You and me, the atheistic scientists, say that you and I, we've evolved to this point, and the reason our brains seek meaning and truth has nothing to do with truth, but has everything to do with survival. And this has led many, many people, Einstein included, to ask the question, therefore, well then why is it that we can trust anything in our brains? And the Christian answer to that is because actually the world is created by an eternal logos, an eternal mind, an eternal reason gave rise to the universe, and that this mind made our universe in an orderly way, that our mind does correspond to reality. Now, it's interesting, therefore, to trace the Christian worldview, that is, the way we view the world, with other ways of viewing the world, and how each of those links to the rise of modern science. It's worth tracing how belief that there is a logos behind the world, that behind the world there is a mind, a thinking personal being who gave rise to the world. It's worth thinking about the link between that idea and the rise of modern science. It's interesting that modern science didn't arise out of Eastern religions, which have taught that the world is an illusion. So Buddhism and Hinduism teach that the world is an illusion and that the goal of life is to transcend material existence and reach some kind of nirvana. Here's the thing, if the world is an illusion, why would you study it? You know, the Bible says the world isn't an illusion. It's made by a God who stands behind it. And suddenly, all things are created. They're real and have their own existence. There is a reality to study. Eastern religions didn't teach that, and as a result, lacked the fertile soil for science to grow in. That's Eastern religions. It's interesting also, modern science didn't arise out of pantheism. Do you know what pantheism is? Pantheism is the view that there is more than one God, more than one power, more than one mind behind the universe. And it's interesting to consider, why is it that modern science didn't arise out of a pantheistic worldview where there are many gods? And the answer is quite simple. If there's one God, then what he would do might be predictable, and you might be able to analyze what he has done. But if there are many gods, then one God might come along and do this, but then another God might come along and do this, and then another God might come and war between them and do something completely different. And so as a result, if you're a pantheist, you believe that there are many gods, you never kind of sit with the reality and try and come up with a coherent explanation for what's happened. If your crops fail or your dad gets sick and dies, there aren't biological or agricultural causes to that, but rather the gods are messing with us human beings. And as a result, we've got to go off to a temple and try and appease one of the many gods in the universe. So the solution, that's the solution. So the result is the primitive people who worship many gods, they lack the skills of critical thinking and empiricism, which really is at the heart of modern science. A pantheistic worldview didn't give rise to modern science. Modern science didn't arise out of Islam either. Despite the Arab world holding on to the writings of Aristotle between 500 AD and 1100 AD, at a time when they'd been lost to the West had lost the writings of Aristotle. Fascinating history. We kind of think Aristotle is in the Western tradition, but it was Islam that had the books, Aristotle's books, and gave them back to the West in 1100 AD. But the question is, why didn't Islam produce modern science? And many people have written about this, and one of the reasons is because in Islam there is a fatalism, which is part of Islam, which teaches that everything is determined. And if that's the case, there's no point trying to understand why things happen, because all things are unchangeable. All things happen according to the will of Allah. You don't question the will of Allah. It just is. And many people believe that's why modern science didn't arise out of Islam as well. I could go on. Let me go on. One more. Modern science didn't arise out of Greek philosophy either. Science has two very important complementary aspects. And one is theory, and you might call that rationalism. Let's see if I've got this. So this is rationalism. With our mind's eye and with our imagination, we posit truths about the world, and in our minds we come up with theories for the way things work. The other way of viewing things is empiricism, which is not starting with our mind and thinking about an idea, but starting with the world and our perception of the world and coming up with tests and experiments to try and work out, are there regularities in the world? That's what empiricism is. And there's a lot of debate about whether Aristotle was a rationalist or an empiricist, and it was possibly both, but the Western tradition that arised out of Aristotle, Greek philosophy, was dominated by the idea that there are principles to which the universe must conform. So Western philosophy starts with the mind's eye and what's in the head, and Aristotle came up with the idea that perfect motion must be circular. Here's an example of kind of how it works. Aristotle came up with the idea that perfect motion must be circular. And as a result, into the Western view of philosophy and science came the idea that the planets out there, kind of anything beyond the moon was perfect in kind of Greek philosophy. And therefore, because circular motion is kind of the most pure form of motion, it was believed in Greek philosophy that the planets must orbit one another in a perfect sphere. Now, in the kind of 15th, 16th century, I can't remember when, but Kepler came along, and rather than starting with the mind and thinking perfect motion is spherical or circular, he actually went out and tested it. Rather than starting with a theory, he went out to reality and started working out actually a spherical motion of planets orbit. That actually doesn't work, and he came up with the elliptical. You know what an ellipsis is? It's like an oval. He came up with the elliptical way the planets orbit, and he was right. And it's interesting that it took up until the 16th century for Kepler to conclude that, and that is because the whole Western tradition of philosophy was so indebted to Aristotle, the rationalism of Aristotle, that posits a theory in the head and then goes out and says, this is the way things must be. And modern science really didn't arise until empiricism came along. And empiricism came along with this man. Let's see if we've got him. I don't. Wait, let me just go forward. With this man, Francis Bacon. He looks cool, doesn't he? There's some very cool paintings of Francis Bacon. Not to be confused with the artist Francis Bacon, who does those crazy modern kind of artworks. But Francis Bacon really was the father of empiricism, this idea that you go out and test your ideas and you make experiments, and that's really where modern science arose out of. And what I've been saying to you is that why did modern science arise? Science as we know it exploded onto the world stage in Europe in the 16th and 17th century. And the argument I've so far made is that it didn't arise out of Islam, it didn't arise out of pantheism, many gods, didn't arise out of Greek philosophy. Modern science didn't arise out of the Eastern religions, which see the universe as an illusion. It arose out of Europe in the 16th and 17th century. Why is that? Now, the history of this is very easy to find and read. The question is why 16th, 17th century Europe? And the thesis is often called Whitehead's thesis. And I want to give you two quotes here. Melvin Carter, he wrote in the 20th century, a Nobel Prize winning chemist, and this is what he says, that the universe is governed by a single God and is not the product of whims of many gods, pantheism, each governing his own province according to his own laws. This monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation of modern science. That's what Melvin Carter says. But it's actually called Whitehead's thesis because Alfred North Whitehead was one of the greatest historians of science and philosophy on science. And in one of his books, he observed that medieval Europe in 1500 knew less than Archimedes in the 3rd century BC. And yet by 1700 AD, Newton had written his Principia Mathematica, and Whitehead said, how do you get such rapid expansion of scientific knowledge within a 200-year period? And this is his thesis. He said, modern science must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God. There is a logos, a mind behind the world. My explanation is that faith in the possibility of science. Do you get that? Faith in the possibility of science, because there is a reason behind the world that gives rise to the possibility of doing science, generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory. It's an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. Now, put simply, and I think I've written this on your outline, C.S. Lewis famously said, the quote on page 2 of your booklet, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a divine lawgiver. That's it simply put. And as you look at the rise of science, you start to see that many of the towering figures of science agreed. Men such as Francis Bacon, all of these men were theists. Francis Bacon, father of empiricism. Galileo championed the heliocentric orbit of the solar system, believed in God. Thomas Kepler discovered the elliptical orbit of the planets. Blaise Pascal invented the hydraulic press and the syringe. Robert Boyle, a founder of modern chemistry. Sir Isaac Newton discovered theory of gravitation. Michael Faraday discovered electromagnetic induction, diamagnetism, and electrolysis. Charles Babbage, the first computer scientist, that's why he looks so serious. All right, who's this? Gregor Mendel, the founder of science of genetics. Does anyone know the minister at York Street, Justin Moffat? Doesn't this guy look like Justin Moffat? He does a lot, doesn't he? Louis Pasteur discovered the principles of vaccination and pasteurization. Lord Kelvin established the correct value of absolute zero. You know, Kelvin, we measure the units of temperature in Kelvin. That's him. Imagine getting your own unit of temperature. That would be pretty cool. James Clerk Maxwell, theory of electromagnetic radiation. Okay, and so all of these men were theists, most of them Christians, and many of them were actually priests in the church. Far from belief hindering science, the history actually shows that Christianity drove science. Whitehead's thesis is that men expected there to be law in nature. Why? Because they believed in a lawgiver. And as we go into the 20th and 21st century, we have men today like John Polkinghorne, the particle physicist, Francis Collins, former director of the Human Genome Project, John Lennox, Oxford mathematician, William Phillips, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and Alvin Plantinga, not a scientist, but one of the world's leading philosophers right now. And so that's the question. History, hasn't Christianity suppressed science? And the answer is no. Christianity gave rise in the 16th and 17th century to the modern view of science, which started in a Christian Europe. Before I go on, though, point one's going to be by far the longest. Before I go on, one of the men I've mentioned was Galileo. And Galileo is often brought up as an example of Christianity being opposed to science. I assume you've heard this before, and that the church persecuted him. But it actually turns out, if you read the history, that Galileo was in fact a firm believer in God and the Bible, and remained so all his life. He held that the laws of nature are written by the hand of God in the language of mathematics. Do you hear that? The laws of nature, quote from him, the laws of nature are written by the hand of God in the language of mathematics, and that the human mind, quote, is a work of God and one of the most excellent works of God. Galileo, what we know from history, enjoyed a great deal of support from the religious establishment, especially at the start of his career. He was vigorously opposed, however, and you can look at the history, not by the church, but by secular philosophers who were enraged at his criticism of Aristotle. In his famous letter to the Grand Duchess of Christina, 1615, he claims that it was the academic professors who were so opposed to him because of his opposition to Aristotle's view of the solar system. They were so opposed to him that they tried to influence the church authorities to speak out against him. And what actually happened was that the scientific advisors of the church, they advised the church to reject Aristotle's thesis. And Galileo responded by representing the Pope in one of his books as a dull-witted character whom he called Simplicio, which simply means buffoon, right? And so that didn't actually end up very good for Galileo. It's never good kind of attacking the dominant power of the day. And there is, of course, no excuse whatsoever for the Roman Catholic Church's use of power in the Inquisition to muzzle Galileo. But the history is actually quite clear. Galileo was actually persecuted by the secular philosophers of his day, not by the church, but by them. Why? Because he opposed their Aristotelian view of the universe. The church of the day simply just followed the scientists of the day and ended up wrongly muzzling him through the Inquisition. But there's the science, okay? Has history, hasn't Christianity suppressed science in history? It actually hasn't. It gave rise to what we know as modern science. That's the first point. Second point is this thing about miracles. And let me move to that now. This is the second question, and much, much quicker, I hope. It will be quicker. Aren't miracles scientifically impossible? That's the second problem people have with Christianity. People think the science of buried God, because Christianity, along with other religions, believes in miracles, the intervention of God into the natural order. In Christianity, we celebrate two events on our character, which are actually miracles. One is Christmas, the miracle that Mary, who had never had sexual relations, came to be with child. That's astounding, and it's a miracle. We claim that that was by the intervention of God. And the other miracle we celebrate is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead after being buried and dead for 3 days, the miracle of Easter. And the question is, well, how is it that serious, rational, modern people could possibly believe in these things such as miracles? I mean, surely if you are a seriously minded person, you have to write off Christianity at this point as simply being myth. None of us have ever come to believe that a woman who ends up with child never had sexual relations and that dead people come back from the grave. We simply don't believe that today. Why is it that Christians believe that? How can the Bible be a reliable account of history when it contains descriptions of miracles? Now, let me show you Richard Dawkins, the Oxford biologist, the leading atheist of our day. He says this: any belief in miracles is flat contradictory, not just to the facts of science, but to the spirit of science, right? The spirit of science is you keep searching for explanations, natural explanations, until you found one. If something doesn't make sense to you, you don't just recourse to God did it. No, you keep searching for an explanation of why that happened. But here's the thing: science hasn't proven that miracles aren't possible. All science can prove is what the natural causes can do. Science is limited to account for events in our world in terms of the things of this world. But Christians claim that Jesus Christ rose from the dead not by a power within this world, but by the power of God external to this world. This is why, I haven't quoted him, but this is why men like Francis Collins, John Lennox, believe in the possibility of miracles. It's because that Christians and religious people aren't claiming that by natural processes, men are raised from the dead and women are come to be with child by natural processes. No, what we suggest is that these things happen by a supernatural power, which has intervened from outside our closed universe system. Now, let me give you an illustration of this from the Oxford mathematician John Lennox. He gives this illustration. He says, if on two nights I put $10 into my drawer, the laws of arithmetic tell me that I have $20 in my drawers. But then he says, if I wake up in the morning and find only $5 in the drawer, I don't conclude that the laws of arithmetic have been broken, but possibly the laws of Australia have been broken at that point. And then he goes on to explain this. The laws of nature, they describe to us the regularities on which the universe normally runs. But God, who created the universe with those laws, is no more their prisoner than the thief is a prisoner to the laws of arithmetic. A thief can step into your bottom drawer from outside and tinker with the money in your drawer. The laws of arithmetic don't say that that can't happen. Actually, the laws of arithmetic tell you that something has happened. And so do the laws of nature. The reason we know that there's a miracle is because dead people don't naturally come back to life. That's how you actually know that a miracle has taken place. Miracles violate the laws of nature, and so this is the belief. Miracles violate the laws of nature, so they cannot occur. But that is not actually true. The laws of nature are descriptions of what normally takes place. The laws of nature predict what is bound to happen if the system stays tight. But they cannot account, to argue that the laws of nature make it impossible for us to believe in the existence of God and the possibility of God's intervention into the system, well, that is plainly false. God made our world. He made it run in an orderly fashion with the laws He's created, but He can step into it from outside and play with it. So are miracles scientifically impossible? They're not. And what is very, very interesting right now is that David Hume is the chief skeptic who has kind of presented this idea that miracles are a scientific impossibility. One of the great kind of rationalist, atheist philosophers of the, 18th, 19th century? 18th, thank you, Tristan. You should come up and lecture this. But the key Hume commentator in our world today is a man by the name of, do you know, Tristan? Hey? On Hume. I've forgotten his name. Not Thomas Nagel. Anthony Flew. Very interesting. Anthony Flew in the 20th century was very much the most famous atheist. And the 21st century, about 15 years ago, he moved out of atheism and into theism, not into Christianity, but largely because he realized that David Hume was wrong and that miracles are philosophically possible in our world today. It's worth chasing down Anthony Flew. He came under the immense criticism of all the atheists who couldn't believe he'd moved from atheism and into theism. And right now, philosophy has actually no problem with the ideas that miracles are possible. Possible doesn't mean the philosophers believe they've happened, but it isn't a philosophical issue anymore. And so that's that point. Okay, thirdly, the question of evolution. What about evolution? Doesn't evolution disprove the first chapters of the Bible? Genesis 1 and 2, well, no. Evolutionary science assumes more complex life forms evolved from less complex forms through a process of natural selection. This is Dawkins. For centuries, he says, the most powerful argument for God's existence from the physical world was the so-called argument from design. But Darwin provided a simpler explanation. That is random mutation through natural selection. And he thinks that this has explained away the need for a designer in our world. Francis Collins doesn't think so, and many theistic scientists don't think this at all. In fact, Francis Collins says this: I don't see that Professor Dawkins' basic account of evolution is incompatible with God's having designed it. Let me just see, where am I going at this point? I've lost myself. Here's where we're going. So Dawkins comes along and he says that natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered, is the explanation for the existence of life on Earth. And there's a very famous illustration. William Paley, the theistic philosopher in the, my history is not very good, in the 18th century, I think he was, he came up with this idea of the divine watchmaker, that if you were to walk along in a forest and find a watch, you wouldn't conclude that the universe had created it out of nothing. You would conclude that there is a designer who made this watch and who was wearing it and dropped it in the forest, and you'd somehow discovered it. Richard Dawkins, he says, no, Darwin solved that problem. He says that the process of natural selection plays the role of watchmaker in nature, such that we have a complex life form today, human being, incredibly complex, especially the human eye, one of the most complex things in all of the universe. But these things have arisen through a process of natural selection and evolution. From simple things, we've arrived at complex things. And he thinks, yes, Darwin have solved the problem, and that the mechanism of natural selection is the explanation for life on Earth today. But this is actually what many philosophers go on to show. Richard Dawkins at this point commits what philosophers call a category mistake. Just because Richard Dawkins Darwin has discovered the mechanism by which life has evolved, doesn't explain away the need and the reality of an agent who created that thing in the first place and designed it. Here's a couple of little explanations. The existence of a mechanism, that is, an engine that drives a Ford motor car, that doesn't do away. If you're an engineer and you can explain the mechanism of an engine in a car that propels a car forward, just because you can explain that mechanism, that doesn't do away with the reality of Henry Ford, who designed an engine in the first place. Here's another illustration example. Imagine my daughter Maisie asks me why the kettle is boiling. And I describe to her that the electricity comes to the kettle, it makes the element in the kettle get hot, the heat is transferred by conduction to the water in the kettle, so that the atoms in the water are agitated and begin to move and boil. That's why the kettle is boiling, Maisie. Now, at that point, what would my daughter do? Maisie would go to her mom and ask her, yeah, but why is the kettle boiling? To which my wife would answer a more simple answer, because I am making a cup of tea for your husband tonight. That explains the difference between an argument from agent and an argument from mechanism. Just because you can explain the process of evolution, it doesn't actually do away with the reality of the designer over the top of it. Just because you can explain a mechanism, evolution, by natural selection, as Charles Darwin did, that doesn't at all do away with the possibility or the reality of an agent who designed this process, this mechanism. Okay, so that leads us to this issue of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Don't Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 disagree with this view of evolution? At this point, I want to just do a little bit of philosophy of science And Ian Barber, the Templeton Prize-winning physicist, and who is the foremost expert in the dialogue between science and religion in the 20th century and the early 21st century, he views the relationship between science and religion in four different ways. And he says that you can kind of have a conflict model which posits science versus religion. So either one is true or the other. Here's the other model, an independent model, that is science and religion can both be true as long as they're kept in their separate domains. There's the dialogue model, which is science and religion are conversation partners in the areas mentioned. They're dialogue partners, and they both have a kind of knowledge which they should bring to bear on the other party. And then there's the integration model. This model takes dialogue and conversation much further and posits the truth of science and religion can be integrated into a more complete and full whole. Now, at one end of the spectrum are both the proponents of creation science and atheistic evolution. So this is kind of the main model our media loves to talk to us about. That is that Richard Dawkins says, because science is like this, you cannot possibly believe in a creator. And then you have, on the other hand, some of creation science, men by the name of Ken Ham, who argue that really we should ignore what science has found and stick with what Genesis teaches about a literal six-day creation. And that's really what most of media kind of gets at. But really there are different ways of looking at science. Some people kind of prefer to see science and faith. Faith is a privatized, subjective thing, which is kept far away from science. That's the independence model. But really, as Christians, we have to have some kind of model like dialogue or integration, which is what Ian Barber argues for. Different Christian thinkers use all four of these models. And so some insist that Genesis chapter 1 teaches that God created all life forms in a period of 6 24-hour days, just several thousand years ago. And you'd probably say that that's in this conflict model, which seems to conflict quite heavily with the science of our day. At the other end of the spectrum are Christians who take the independence model and simply say that God was the primary cause in the beginning of the world, and after that, natural causes took over. So that's the integration approach. Some hold that God created life and then guided natural selection to develop all complex life forms from simpler ones. And then a fourth model really sees that there are gaps in the fossil record, and they claim that species seem to pop up and appear rather than develop from simpler forms, and they believe that God performed large-scale creative acts at different points over long periods of time. So there's four different ways Christians deal with science and evolution. First model is they read Genesis 1 very literalistically. The second model is that they posit God threw the universe into being, kind of set back, and evolution, he'd wound up the clock pretty much, and evolution just rolled on. The third model is that God kind of guided the process of evolution. And the fourth model is that, no, actually, there are such large gaps in the fossil record that God must have done special creations at particular points in time, and that humankind would be one of those special creations, which he kind of jumped in to the kind of history of our world and created a special creation, which is human beings made in the image of God. Now, to be honest, I actually don't know where I sit on all of this. And the reason I don't know is I actually don't think, as a Christian, that you completely have to know. And that's because, as a Christian, I'm bound by what the Bible teaches me. And the Bible simply doesn't teach me much about the science by which the universe was created. In fact, if you go back to Genesis chapter 1, you see Genesis chapter 1, it's not a historical record of what happened, nor is it kind of pure poetry, but it's somewhere between, and it has a very clear agenda, which is to teach us that God made our world in an orderly way, that it was very good, and that human beings are the special creation of a God who knows us, loves us, and chose to make us out of every other creature in His image. So that's what I stick with, that's what I believe, and as a Christian, that's what you need to believe because that's what the Bible teaches. But the process by which God did that, whether He kind of wound it up and threw it into being, whether He guided it through history, or whether He intervened in particular points to make special creations, I actually don't know. And for me, that's a scientific question, which I haven't had the time, really, to explore. But it's a question I don't need to explore, because the Old Testament, Genesis 1, fits with each one of those models. And so that's evolution. Fourthly, and finally, this question, isn't faith by definition believing where there is no evidence? That's what the new atheists would have us believe. I watched a number of debates between Richard Dawkins this week and a whole number of Christians, and each time he makes a statement, I'm not sure whether I've got it here, no. He makes a statement that faith is believing where there is no evidence. And that simply isn't the way any Christian, that's not what Christians at all mean by this idea of faith. And I want to prove that to you by this quote from the end of John's Gospel. At the end of John's Gospel, Jesus has risen from the dead and He appears to His disciples, but one of His disciples gets left out, Thomas, who went down in history as Doubting Thomas. Which is a little bit of a shame because he ends up believing in the end, so he really should have been called Believing Thomas. But anyway, that's beside the point. And Thomas famously said, "No, unless I put my finger into the holes in his hands and my hand in his side, I will not believe." And finally, Jesus appears to Thomas, and Thomas says, "My Lord and my God, I believe." Finally, he believes. And after that, Jesus says this, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed." Now, many atheists jump on this and they say, there you go. See, there you go, you Christians. There you go, a statement from the lips of Jesus where He is saying that belief, faith, is when you believe in the absence of evidence. Blessed are those who have no evidence and yet have believed. That's what many people say. But that is actually a complete misunderstanding of what Jesus is saying here. Thomas believed because he saw. But seeing is only one way of coming to terms with evidence. Seeing is one form of evidence, but there are many other kinds of evidence which don't include seeing. There are many kinds of evidence. And what Jesus goes on to say is this, John chapter 20, verse 30, Jesus goes on to say, this is what the gospel says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of His disciples, which are not recorded in the gospel of John, but these are written. These stories about Jesus' miracles are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. In other words, the New Testament expects not that you would believe without evidence, but that you would believe on the basis of the eyewitness evidence. You have four Gospels written by four different eyewitnesses, and that's the evidence God expects you to believe in the Son of God, Jesus the Messiah. Christianity isn't believing where there is no evidence. No, no, no. If you're a Christian, you should never believe anything which doesn't have evidence. So what is the evidence we have? Well, we can't see Jesus. He doesn't walk through here with holes in his hands and his side. So what evidence do we have? We have the evidence of the eyewitness testimony that they saw Jesus die and rise. And we looked at that evidence a number of weeks ago by looking at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And you can listen to that on our website. Christianity isn't believing where there is no evidence. In fact, routinely, the Bible rejects the superstition of people who believe things without any evidence. Jesus doesn't expect us to believe without evidence. He gives us the evidence of his life, his teachings, his death, his resurrection, and he expects us to deal with that evidence and to make a proper evaluation of that evidence and come to faith. In one of the debates, John Lennox is debating Richard Dawkins, and it's very humorous. Richard Dawkins says, no, faith is believing where there is no evidence. And John Lennox asks Richard Dawkins, do you believe your wife loves you? And Richard Dawkins goes, of course. And John Lennox asks, well, is there any evidence for that? And it's very interesting to watch Richard Dawkins kind of shift and hide and get out from underneath that. You know, Dawkins and many people would have us believe faith is this belief where there is no evidence. That's not how anyone uses the language of faith. Faith simply means trust. It means commitment to an idea you know to be true. It's based on evidence. And as a result, as a Christian, you can be scientifically minded because Jesus asks you not to believe where there is no evidence, but to believe on the basis of the evidence of the things he has said and done, and primarily that he rose from the dead. And you can access that by the evidence of history. I think those four things, in answering those four questions, the question of history, Christianity really did give rise to the scientific method, the question of miracles, philosophers have concluded that miracles aren't a scientific impossibility so long as there is a supernatural power that's intervening from above. That's possible. Whether there is a scientific power above, you know, you got to work that out, but it is possible if a supernatural power exists, they can intervene and do miracles. Thirdly, evolution. It actually leads us, the process of evolution leaves us to conclude there must be a designer. And then fourthly, faith. When Jesus asks us to put our trust in him, he's not asking us to ignore the evidence. He's asking us to look at the evidence and to make a wise decision. That's why I think it is clear that you can be a Christian and a scientist, and in fact many people in this room are Christians and scientists, and it's worth going and talking to them about why that is the case. And I'm probably going to throw you in the deep end here, Ben Waterhouse, who has a PhD in mathematics and is a Christian. And so it's worth going. He should have really given this message, not me. But let me, I'm going to pray, lead us in prayer. And I might open up for two questions if there are any. I don't know how I've gone for time because my watch didn't work. Heavenly Father, we ask that if you really are out there, that you might make yourself known to us. God, if you're there, show us the evidence that we might not live in ignorance, but that we might live rationally, reasonably in the light of the evidence. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, each one of these weeks, I am going to give time for questions as we look at each one of these objections. I don't know what time it is. Oh, I do. We've got a little bit of time, but I might just take two questions. Are there any questions on any of this? Yes, the gentleman right at the back of the room. We'll get a microphone to you so that we can hear you down the front.
One of the prerequisites for evolution is that you have death.
Yes.
Without death, evolution doesn't occur. So if evolution is the means by which God created, how do you reconcile that with a perfect earth in the beginning, as Genesis 1 says, and various other chapters of the Bible, and that we return to this perfect earth? you've got death before the fall in evolution, which is contrary to 1 Corinthians 15 and Romans 8. How do you reconcile those two? Death before the fall, death is a natural part, death is the means by which God created, with something that seems to be antithetical to what the Bible has said from beginning to end. And Genesis to Revelation.
Great question. This has been the biggest question for me as I've wrestled with the science and the Bible. And I'm still pretty unresolved in these things, so I've got to be careful. But I think what I've come to see from the Bible is that it is the death of human beings which is not natural to the world we live in, not the death of plant life or animal life. And the reason I see that is because in Genesis 2, there are two trees, one the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the other the tree of life. And by eating from the tree of life, it seems as though human beings would have lived forever. And when human beings rebelled against God in Genesis chapter 3, God kicks them out of the garden so that, why did he kick them out? He kicked them out so that they couldn't reach out and take from the tree of life and live forever. Now, why did God do that? Kind of seems harsh. Why did he introduce death at that point? And I think it's actually quite clear, God didn't want us living forever in our selfish, greedy, sinful, rebellious state. And he said, you want to rebel from me? Well, there's an end that your life is going to come to an end, and I will not allow you to go on living for yourself in rebellion against me and harming others forever and ever and ever. So I take it that the tree of life was the means by which you and I could have eaten and lived forever. Human beings rebel against God, he kicks them out, and as a result, death comes to human beings. Why? Because they can't take out and eat from the tree of life. So I take it that, therefore, that the animals, plant life, there was a process of death, burial, regeneration, that kind of thing, prior to the fall, and that after the fall, it's not an unnatural state. Even though Romans 8 speaks about the groaning of creation, I take it that creation groans because the world isn't under the dominion of God. It's under the dominion of rebels, pirates. Pirates have taken possession of the world. The world belongs to God, and we were meant to be his sub-rulers. But right now, we're pirates. We ignore the rightful ruler and we run the world the way we want to run it. And we rape it and we abuse the world. We rape and pillage the world and we use it for ourselves. And as a result, it's groaning to be put back to the state where human beings responsibly tend the world. So there's my explanation. We'll have to, if you want further questions, we'll have to talk about it afterwards. Yeah, so the question is, a Rottweiler eating the heart out of a lamb, is that part of God's good creation? And I think that's a very emotional argument, right? I don't want to say yes to that. But I do, you know, I was snorkeling down at Bondi Beach yesterday, and it was incredible with my daughter Maisie, and we're swimming through. There are amazing fish teeming in the sea. And I was just waiting for a bigger fish to come along and eat one of those smaller fish. And I do think that is part of the glory of creation. I think the reason we struggle with that idea about a Rottweiler and is a lamb is because blood. We're not okay with blood. It's very difficult. And so, yeah, I'm not sure that I can't actually see anywhere in the Bible where the idea of animals eating one another is inconsistent with the Bible's teaching.